from Community Public Radio, this is the CPR News. From New York, I'm Don DeBar. More Israeli settlements expansion and more demolitions of Palestinian homes. We have this report from Press TV.
Israel's planning to demolish more Palestinian-owned homes in the occupied West Bank as part of its settlement expansion projects. Local sources say Israeli forces invaded the neighborhoods of Silwan and Jabal al-Mukabir and handed demolition orders to a number of Palestinian families. The Israeli troops told the residents to leave their homes. They said that the homes had to be destroyed because they'd been built illegally. Israel is trying to expand its settlements in the West Bank despite international criticism. Palestinians say that Tel Aviv wants to drive them out of the occupied territory and grab their land in a bid to Judaize the West Bank. Palestinian writer and journalist Soel Al-Natour joins us now to tell us more about the continued expansion of the Israeli settlements and the land grabs and expulsion of Palestinians from Jerusalem al-Quds and from the West Bank, and as they continue with no accountability and impunity.
Well, three factors directly comes to the mind of everyone when you hear that the Israelis are continuing the settler colonialism to be widespread in the West Bank. The first is deriving from the mentality and the slogan about the Judaization of all Palestine in order to get more settler colonialists of the Zionists and kick out the Palestinians from their original land. The second, and the Americans are financing all these settler colonialism and are fabricating all the pretext to say this is sheltering and no one can forbid the sheltering, which they knew this is against the international law, and in spite of this, they are encouraging the Israelis to continue like this. And in the actual situation where the Israeli government is paralyzed, it seemed that the practical things on the spot is not directly the responsibility of the government, which is not true. The government is making lately, that last 24 hours, two things. One, a decree about confiscating 321 dunam on the west of Ramallah, and another decree is to consecrate 35 other dunam to widen the settlement. The colonies. In these things, I think it's very clear that the process of Judaization will continue. If we see where it's concentrated in the area between Ramallah and Jerusalem, because the west of Ramallah is Jerusalem, and if we see that they close many big streets of Ramallah to go on and to continue, in spite that before that the Israelis did it, and there was a plan by the Palestinians to the High Court, and the High Court ordered the Israeli army to open back and to stop the colonization. Now this is the time where the Israelis are trying. Now the process practically on the land is taking, on one hand, demolish the Palestinian houses. Second is forbid the Palestinians to create new houses for their shelters. So in this process, if we see that not allowing the Palestinians to continue living is the direct influence to get them out.
The fallout continued Wednesday from the previous day's release of a Senate report detailing torture and other violations of international human rights laws committed by U.S. officials, agents, and contractors. State Department spokesperson Jen Psaki faced a barrage of questions from reporters at her daily press conference Wednesday.
What the report does is point out a problem. It doesn't hold anyone accountable for it. You regularly complain from this podium, and embassies do abroad as well, when foreign governments do not follow through and hold people accountable for what you consider to be wrongdoing. Since you consider what this report outlines to have been wrongdoing, how can you continue to make those kind of cases, to make those arguments, if no one is actually going to be held accountable here at home?
Well, Matt, I think what we'd point to is that We're willing to be transparent about our mistakes. We learn from them and we change. And our actions are evidence of that.
All of that is wonderful. You're willing to be transparent about it, although I would say that it took quite a long time for this to come out.
You're willing to be transparent about it.
The transparency is only half of the question here. The other part of it is, if someone did wrong, are they going to be punished for it? And the answer from the administration seems to be no. So you seem to be saying that, well, we can just air our dirty laundry however you want to describe it, and that's it. That's done with it. Well, when other countries do that, and only that, you say that's not acceptable. How is it that you're going to be able to keep a straight face if you accept the report findings but don't do anything about it?
Well, Matt, we did do something about it. We ended the practice. I think that's significant, and countries will see that.
Yeah, but you supported, say, and I'm not at all comparing these things, you supported war crimes trials and things like that for other countries. The point of those things that you support is to hold people actually accountable and to punish them if they did something wrong. You're saying in this instance that people did bad things, that wrong things, things that contravened U.S. values, but you're at the same time saying that you're not prepared to hold them accountable.
I would encourage you to have a conversation with the Department of Justice. I don't have anything to add from the State Department.
Does the State Department have any concerns that its arguments in Human Rights Forum around the world, particularly today, Human Rights Day, are compromised at all by the fact that there isn't going to be any accountability here, and that you think that just publishing a report, or the Senate majority publishing this report, is good enough? No concerns?
Matt, I think in all of our conversations with countries around the world, we'll continue to convey that we ended this practice. It was one of the first steps the president made. We're willing to be open and transparent about our mistakes and make changes, and that's exactly what we did
here. So the answer is that you're basically going to say, it's going to be kind of parental. Do as I say, not as I have done or do.
Actually,
is that correct?
I think we made the decision to lay out very transparently what exactly we had done in the past that we didn't think was consistent with our values. And I think that's showing strength as a nation, and that's the conversation we'll have with countries around the world.
People will argue that showing strength is not just revealing this, but actually doing something about it other than just ending it.
And the practice.
You can't just end it and not punish anybody and claim that it's... I mean, some would argue that you can't just stop doing it, then reveal it, and then not punish anybody for it. You're not going, you're only halfway
there. I have nothing to add to what the Department of Justice has said.
It was very detailed, the report yesterday, about four Al-Qaeda suspects and the way that they were treated. I mean, some of the techniques that you were talking about, repeated beatings, people being hung from their hands, shackled to ceilings, left naked. It's a pretty medieval way of treating people in captivity, isn't it?
Well, I think you saw the President of the United States and the Secretary of State both release strong statements yesterday indicating that those tactics, those techniques are not consistent with our values. That's why these programs were ended 5 years ago. At the same time, we believe that obviously the men and women who are serving in our intelligence agencies, the men and women who have served to help keep our country safe, are playing important roles and one that we have great value and respect for. But it doesn't mean that those tactics and techniques should be continued.
I presume, but I don't know, and I want to make sure that your response to the question about other countries calling for investigations and prosecutions, I think, was we believe that our own legal authorities are competent. So that response would apply to both the UN special rapporteur for torture. He's saying that they should be
prosecuted. I think
prosecuted.
I also said that obviously there are a range of legal questions. I just have to talk to our legal team about.
I understand, but your response to them calling for prosecutions, the special rapporteur on torture and another one for UN, these are people who you supported getting these positions in the UN system. They're both calling for prosecution, saying there should be no statute of limitations and no immunities granted. Your response to them would be the same as your response to the countries.
Well, I think I said two things. One was, broadly speaking, we're committed, of course, to complying by our domestic and international obligations. We believe the U.S. justice system is the appropriate place for allegations about conduct by U.S. officials to be handled. But there are also a range of different questions about
right.
legal obligations and, you know, the convention, and I have to just talk to our legal
okay.
team
can,
and see if there's more.
Can you check to see if there is an answer? If you're, because it would seem to me that if you don't go ahead, or I don't know, the question is, if you don't prosecute what you consider to be wrongdoing, does that put you in violation of your international obligations, something that you complain regularly that other countries are in violation of? So if you could
sure.
get that.
And
then,
we'll
and then the second part of my question is, you say that the U.S. justice system is the appropriate place, that you believe that it's appropriate and credible. Don't you see how people could find that amusing at best and disingenuous at worst, given the fact that no one's going to be prosecuted for this? It's not even going to get to the justice system.
Matt,
for
I think
there to
the Department of
trial.
Justice has spoken to this. I don't have anything further
to
add.
Well, I'm not asking you about that decision. I'm asking you about the implications of that decision as it relates to foreign policy, and you're attempting to get other countries to abide by international obligations and commitments that the administration is not abiding by themselves.
Well, I'm not going to make a sweeping generalization. I'm probably not going to entertain any specific example of comparison you have, Matt, but obviously, again, this happened, these programs were ended 5 years ago, which is relevant information. This current president of the United States decided to end them, and that's important context in our foreign policy discussions.
Right, but so the foreign policy of the United States now rests on if something was done that was wrong and that you stopped it, that's the end of the story.
I don't have anything right? more to add on the justice question. Go ahead, Abby.
Do you believe that anyone who participated in these programs should be allowed to keep their job working?
I'm just not going to speak more specifically to this.
The statement from Ben Emmerson said that, you know, states are not free to maintain or permit impunity for these crimes under the conventions. But currently you're saying that if the U.S. continues its policy of not prosecuting anyone who is responsible for these programs, you're not aware of whether, or it's not clear whether the U.S. would still be in compliance with its conventions.
That's not at all what I said, actually. But I conveyed that, broadly speaking, we believe that our legal system is the most appropriate place for U.S. For individual cases in the United States to be handled. Mm-hmm. I can check with our legal team and see if there's more to offer on this particular question.
That's what they're asking for. They're saying that the U.S. justice system should be responsible for this. And the U.S. justice system is saying, we're not going to do anything about it. And
well,
that
the U.S. justice system, which
problem.
Is independent, is responsible for making their own decisions. I'm not going to speak to it further.
Well, bringing prosecutions is a responsibility of the Justice Department, which
Correct.
Is a part of the administration.
The Justice Department, which is independent.
Exactly.
I have nothing further to add.
The problem, the question is, how does the State Department, which routinely calls on other governments to prosecute this kind of thing, how are you going to be able to do that with a straight face or with even a modicum of self-respect if you're not willing to, if another branch of the administration isn't willing to do that here?
Well, as you know, because you're familiar with how the government works and is divided, the U.S. Department of Justice makes decisions about legal cases. That's why I would point you to them.
Right.
As it relates to foreign policy, the relevant context of the decisions that have been made more than 5 years ago, long before this report, is important context.
I guess the question, though, is a pretty clear-cut one, which is whether the U.S. is in compliance with its international obligations under the U.N.
I just said
Convention.
We're committed to complying with our international obligations.
But your commitment notwithstanding, whether the U.S. is in compliance is a question that the Special Rapporteur is saying that if the U.S. doesn't prosecute anyone, that it won't be in compliance.
I
so
will check with
is,
our legal team and see if there's more to add. I just answered that question seven times.
If you could ask
Go ahead.
Them.
Wednesday marked two important dates at the U.N., International Human Rights Day, commemorating the signing in 1948 of the UN Declaration of Human Rights, and the 30th anniversary of the adoption of the Convention Against Torture. This year saw an unusual day to commemorate both, with the release of the CIA torture report and the release of another report detailing police killings in the U.S. at a rate of about two every day. According to that study, in the month between July 17th and August 17th this year, 59 people were killed by police in the United States. The first report, the long-awaited Senate Intelligence Committee report on CIA torture practices, which was finally released Tuesday after years of haggling, may be the most important document released since the Pentagon Papers, So says Shahid Buttar, executive director of the Bill of Rights Defense Committee, who also said that no two things make it more clear that there is not equal justice in this country than torture with impunity, juxtaposed against mass incarceration and extrajudicial assassination by police of unarmed black men in the U.S. He spoke with Black Agenda Radio's Glenn Ford Monday.
This could be the most important document with respect to revealing the crimes of U.S. intelligence agencies since the Pentagon Papers. There hasn't been anything of this sort in a generation in America. And it's striking that even after the several years and millions of dollars it took to compile it, that it took this long to see it. You know, people have been clamoring for the release of the report, including members of Congress from both of the major political parties, for literally years. And the efforts that were arrayed by the CIA to continue keeping the truth from the public included not only destroying evidence of torture with the videotapes that were destroyed years ago, not only hacking the U.S. Senate, committing espionage operations against the people's representatives, not only stealing Senate documents, not only filing false claims at the Justice Department attempting to intimidate Senate staff doing their jobs, and not only lying about all of that, but all of that together. Remember, this is to cover up underlying human rights abuses that no one's ever been held accountable for. So the one thing that I think is really striking in this moment of history is the dramatic difference between the different systems of justice. You know, if you're a young, unarmed black man, you face extrajudicial assassination for having not even done anything wrong. Whereas if you are a torturer, you can continue drawing a taxpayer-funded paycheck as large as $250,000 for life in the case of Ninth Circuit Judge Che Bybee, despite bearing culpability for violations of our species' most fundamental commitments. There is clearly no equal justice in this country, and no two things make it more clear than torture with impunity juxtaposed with mass incarceration.
And in fact, the United States does not officially have a definition of torture.
Indeed. I mean, to this point, you know, torture has been, under the Bush administration, it was an instrument of enhanced interrogation. Under the Obama administration, it's forced feeding at Guantanamo Bay, as well as the continued practice of solitary confinement that occurs across the U.S. prison system. You know, torture is unfortunately endemic across the United States. And even if we didn't think of forced feeding and solitary confinement as torture, even though the rest of the world does, we at least are violating international law every day, and we have every day under the Obama administration, but we failed to prosecute credible allegations up the chain of command everywhere that the evidence leads.
As you said, people have been waiting on this report for years. This is not just a case of the CIA, one agency, stonewalling the Congress, is it, though? It seems that the administration and the CIA are playing tag team of a kind.
Absolutely. I mean, this is exactly what we should expect from a recidivist agency with such a rogue background. And it's worth noting, starting this week, on December 10th through the 15th, is a national week of action around the country to draw attention to CIA and NSA crimes, including mass surveillance in the case of the NSA and torture by the CIA. But it goes one step further. The cover-ups that the CIA has engaged in surrounding torture are just the latest of their agency's crimes. If you go back into the 80s, then it's interesting to connect, for instance, CIA secrecy to Ferguson. And it's not that hard. People think of police militarization in this country as an isolated phenomenon. It was grounded in a specific history. The reason police are militarized in the United States is because in the 1990s, they were facing and being outgunned by drug traffickers in U.S. cities around the country. These were drug traffickers equipped and trained by the Central Intelligence Agency, and that's not a conspiracy theory. The CIA admitted it. This is what became the Iran-Contra scandal, and we are dealing with militarized police because of the last time the CIA got away with human rights abuses spanning multiple continents. The torture scandal is the most recent arena. Well, not even, actually. The drone strike regime is even more recent than that. But the CIA has a history of human rights abuses. It's what it does, sort of the human rights abuse agency. But the interesting thing about the current moment is I think Americans are waking up to the various ways in which we are paying costs for the human rights abuses that the CIA committed. When it was running drugs into Latin America, we paid the price with militarized police, and that's part of what the movement in Ferguson and elsewhere is responding to. When the CIA was committing torture, even before that, when it was training the precursors to Al-Qaeda, in Afghanistan in the 1980s. What did that lead to? Not only the 9/11 attacks, but the NSA dragnet mass surveillance. You know, we've been paying the price for CIA crimes for years without policymakers or the mainstream press pinning the tail on the donkey.
But there is this tendency to speak of the CIA as if it is this self-contained entity. It's a law unto itself when it is connected to an administration and to previous administrations.
You know, it is absolutely an extension of administrations, but to be fair, you know, it's not clear how much authority over the CIA the president actually wields. You know, we do know, for instance, that the agency has lied to multiple administrations. And I think it is true that it is, I'll put it this way, it's an anti-democratic agency, not only in the sense of assaulting fundamental rights, but it does seem to be, for all intents and purposes, immune from public oversight. And that should be a very troubling question, because if we claim on the one hand to live in a democracy, and if the president doesn't control the CIA, it begs the question, who does? And the answer to that question is not particularly clear. I'm not the only one asking it. There's a professor at Tufts University who used to serve on the Senate Foreign Relations Committee staff who just wrote a book making exactly this point, national security and double government. And his point is, with respect to the NSA or the CIA or vast parts of the military-industrial complex, it doesn't matter who you vote for because the president really doesn't command any of it. It's an entrenched staff of bureaucrats like John Brennan, for instance, who have sort of insinuated themselves and rendered themselves above the law and above public accountability. And that is a very profound problem in a country that claims to lead the free world.
If the president himself, the commander in chief, is not fully in control of the CIA, then what can a Senate committee do in terms of oversight of that agency?
Well, the biggest thing is just to expose its crimes to the public. The CIA is hidden, and its crimes are hidden not only by a culture of secrecy, but by the complicity, oftentimes, of the members of Congress who are charged with overseeing it. And before, I was remarking just a few minutes ago about how remarkable it is that despite having spent millions of dollars and years compiling this report, that the Senate had to fight for this long for anybody to have a chance to read it. Just last week, on December 4th, it would have been, we delivered 250,000 signatures to Senator Mark Udall, who is a member of the Senate Intelligence Committee, who will not be returning to Congress. And our message to him was, regardless of what the CIA eventually allows to be released to the public by way of limited information, we would like to see him exercise his absolute privilege as a sitting member of Congress to read portions of the report into the congressional record. This is how we found out about the Pentagon Papers, when Senator Mike Gravel said, I don't care if this classified analysis of the Vietnam War is secret. It reveals a mass deception in the same way that the CIA torture report reveals mass deception and worse, human rights abuses, the severe outright rape and even murder of detainees in U.S. custody. These are facts that have to come to light, because as long as they remain under the rug, we will have unanswered questions that others have raised. You know, it's not as though no one's saying that we tortured some folks. Even the U.S. president has said that. But we've never had an accounting of how we tortured folks, how many people we tortured, how we tortured them. Did anyone who committed those violations face justice? And you know, one last thing I'd say here is, when we ask about what a Senate committee could do, and you know, the fundamental answer is transparency. That's the first step to accountability. And it's worth noting why we have an international human rights regime in the first place. Why is there an international ban on torture? Because we fought a world war to set that up. And we sent a Supreme Court justice to prosecute the Nuremberg trials. And it was bad, obviously, for the Bush administration to torture people. That violated the Nuremberg trials. But the precedent, the legal precedent from Nuremberg, was reversed not under the Bush administration. It was reversed under the Obama administration, because the decision to look forward and not back compromises the legal principle that if you commit torture, you go to jail. It doesn't matter if somebody gave you orders. It doesn't matter if you thought there was an emergency. Those were defenses that were raised at Nuremberg and rejected. Those are legal defenses that did not carry water. We fought a world war to set up a human rights regime that said if you commit torture, you go to jail. The administration under which that was lost was the Obama administration. And I think the one thing that a Senate committee, or in this case of Senator Udall, an individual senator, could do is, by giving transparency to the issue enable the rest of the system to work and demand the accountability that to this point the secrecy has precluded. I think that's what we are looking for, is to finally get the facts on torture. And even despite the limited release of portions of the report that were redacted, we still don't know the facts, right? And we won't know the facts until the rest of the report becomes clear. Remember when the Senate sought the declassification of portions of the report, the only part it even wanted the public to see was the executive summary. Why don't we see the rest of it? If the document reveals crimes by people being paid with U.S. taxpayer dollars, why is that still secret? And those are things that all of us, certainly the courts and prosecutors, should know.
Yes, international treaties to which the U.S. is a party and which have the force of U.S. law require that there be remedies, there be punishment, and there be compensation for the victims of torture. But none of that has happened.
That's exactly right. And it's worth noting that the violation of international law includes not only torture in the first instance, but also the failure to prosecute. That's an independent, continuing violation of international law. And it makes, quite frankly, America a rogue state. We can say whatever we want about the land of the free and the home of the brave, but at the moment, there are few countries doing more to damage human rights around the world than the United States. There are other countries that might be doing worse things, but there are no countries that are doing things in as blatant disregard for the legal principles that they also espouse, on the other hand. And of course, we do this while claiming the leadership of the free world, which makes it even worse, because other countries that want to abuse human rights cite our example increasingly as the basis for their own violations. And that's exactly the people who fought World War II are rolling in their graves.
Meanwhile, the problems with police misconduct in the U.S. criminal justice system do not stop with police killings. Police misconduct is also responsible for wrongful convictions, the prevalence of which has come to light only since the use of DNA testing to exonerate the innocent began in 1989. At last report, there have been 321 post-conviction DNA exonerations in the U.S. since the first one in 1989, and 254 exonerations since the year 2000. 20 of those exonerated through DNA served time on death row. Another 16 were charged with capital crimes but not sentenced to death. The average length of time served by exonerees is 13 and a half years. The racial makeup of the 321 exonerees were 202 black defendants, 95 white defendants, 22 Latino defendants, and 2 Asian defendants. DNA-matched suspects and or perpetrators have been identified in 158 of the DNA exoneration cases. Since 1989, there have been tens of thousands of cases where law enforcement identified and pursued particular suspects, only to find upon DNA testing prior to conviction that they were wrongfully accused. Jeffrey Deskovic is one of those who was wrongfully accused and convicted. Since his release from a long prison term, he has been working to free other wrongfully convicted people who are still in prison. We spoke with him Tuesday.
I spent 16 years incarcerated in New York from age 17 to 32. I had been wrongfully convicted of a murder and a rape despite a negative DNA test result. Ultimately, I was exonerated after 16 years through further testing, which not only reaffirmed my innocence, but also identified the actual perpetrator. So yeah, I do have a unique perspective. Certainly the justice system going awry, I'm no stranger to that phenomenon.
Right. And also the justice system coming out with an inappropriate finding that you were guilty of a crime that you didn't commit, and police misconduct in the process of arriving at that finding.
Yeah, sure. over a period of 6 weeks, the police played this. Game with me, in which they had a number of interaction with them over 6 weeks, in which they half the time when they would speak to me, they would talk to me as if I was a suspect, and the other half the time, they would pretend as if they needed my help.
And we'll hear more from Jeffrey Deskovic tomorrow with the remainder of that interview. And that's all the news we have for you right now. For Community Public Radio, I'm Don DeBar in New York. Thanks for listening.